Pinstripe Valley Podcast. I'm Andrew Mearns here with Tanya, and we have a special guest on the podcast today. This is Ben Lindbergh, the writer for Grantland, former EIC at Baseball Prospectus, and co-host of the Effectively Wild podcast. How are you doing, Ben?
Good. Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Happy to have you. So the first question that I have, we're going to talk about the Yankees a little bit in a season preview of sorts. So the first question I have, the Yankees traded away a few assets who could certainly have been useful regulars in 2015, most notably Shane Green and Martin Prado. Do you think the potential of the return justifies those deals, or should fans take a wait-and-see approach?
I think it does, or at least the guys that they got back fill spots that seem to be just as important and could be conceivably the start of a youth movement or what qualifies for one with the Yankees. Eovaldi is a guy that I think has a lot of potential. I mean, as he is maybe the one member of the Yankees rotation who you could actually count on to make starts at this point. So that is a valuable thing. And he's 25 and he throws hard, and you can look at his stuff and say that if it gets a little bit better, he could be really, really good. And Jeff Sullivan did a post on him not long ago at Fangraphs about how he's working on this splitter that is maybe a better version of the changeup he used to have. And maybe if he establishes that, he would be able to unlock the potential that you would think he has based on his velocity. So that seems to be a pretty valuable piece to have. And the other guys they acquired, I mean, Gregorius is a young, good defensive shortstop, which is something they haven't had in a while. So the pieces they got back seem to be guys who could help them. You know, the question is whether they could have done more, whether they should have signed some guys, but I don't really have a problem with the moves that they did make this winter.
Yeah, and trading Prado did open up a hole in the infield, but I guess otherwise you would have a hole in the rotation, and kind of the same idea with how you'd have a hole at shortstop if they didn't get Gregorius. I don't know what they would have done.
Yeah, well, they didn't really have an infield last year, so I guess they would have done what they did then.
Yeah, I believe going into spring training last year, Brian Cashman said third base was Kelly Johnson and a cast of characters, which sounds about right.
Right. And second baseman was what? Was nominally Brian Roberts, but that obviously wasn't going to happen. So yeah, they're compared to what they went into last year with 40-year-old Jeter, Kelly Johnson, Brian Roberts, it seems like the infield at least is significantly upgraded and defensively should be very strong.
Yeah, I think so too.
So I guess my first question, some fans are pretty annoyed that the Yankees decided to re-sign Stephen Drew rather than giving Rob Refsnyder a chance. Since the Yankees previously had success with a shaky defender learning on the job in Robinson Cano, should they have been more willing to try Refsnyder, or does at least trying Drew make more sense?
Yeah, it's funny. I was just looking back at 2005 Cano's defensive stats, and they were ugly.
No.
you never know whether a single year of defensive stats means a whole lot, but he was like negative 20 at that point and is a good second baseman now. So yeah, I don't have a major problem with that. I mean, Refsnyder is, what, 24, and I'm sure he'll get a shot at some point this year, maybe even coming out of spring training. And it's not the worst thing in the world to have Drew around. I know they don't want him to play shortstop, but he could conceivably play shortstop in a pinch. And he should be a good defensive second baseman. I like him as a bounce back candidate. I mean, we had pretty high expectations for Stephen Drew going into last year, and his year was weird enough that you can kind of think that maybe it was just because he didn't have a spring training and he started in the middle of the year, and then he had some injury issues. So he's not old, and maybe he could bounce back and be, you know, a league average player, and that would be fine. And then Refsnyder is depth and maybe gets established and then takes over the job full time in 2016. So I know it's so rare to have a young player on the Yankees who is homegrown and seems to be major league ready. And they've had lots of pitchers like that who maybe up until the last year or two didn't get the shot that people thought they deserved. And so when they actually come up with one of those guys, you want to see him. And particularly because the only regular in the lineup who's under age 31 is Gregorius at this point, I guess. So that would be a second guy, and it would be nice to see someone a little bit younger, but I don't mind it. I think it's okay, and Ref Snyder will get his shot eventually.
Drew has been not terrible in spring training so far, so maybe he is.
Yeah, so that's a good sign.
Yeah, I mean, it would be today.
it would be very strange for someone to get that bad that quickly, to just completely fall off the table. So willing to give him the benefit of the doubt on how strange his schedule was last year, that he still has something left.
It was funny you mentioned that 2005 team. That defense was just atrocious.
Unbelievably bad, right? I think I might actually do a post on that, like a 10-year retrospective on like the worst defense ever. It's kind of amazing if you look back at the defensive ratings on that team. And they won 95 games somehow, even if they had the run differential of a 90-win team, I guess. But still, to have what the defensive stats say was like the worst defense on record, or at least that we have those defensive stats for, and still to be that good is pretty impressive. So I think I might do a look back at that sometime soon.
Yeah, I guess having, you know, prime Alex Rodriguez, Derek Jeter, and pretty good Gary Sheffield, Hideki Matsui in your lineup is pretty nice to have in there.
Yeah, right. But Bernie Williams in center, and or whatever it was, in Sheffield and Matsui in the outfield. Yeah, that was ugly, but they could hit.
It was really awkward seeing late Bernie Williams out there.
It was. Yeah. Bernie was a favorite of mine, and that was sort of sad.
Yeah. So this is kind of a weird question, and I feel like there's no real good answer to this, but what in the world can like fans expect of Alex Rodriguez? Because it feels like a comeback from someone like him with multiple hip surgeries and obviously the checkered past, and essentially 2 years off, is pretty unprecedented.
Yeah, it is. And this spring training was probably important for him. And I know analysts tend to downplay the importance of spring training. And some recent research has shown that maybe it does actually matter a little bit, or it does help you predict what's going to happen in the regular season a little bit. But for most guys, they just come in and you hope that they don't get hurt. And for someone like him, coming off of such a long absence and such serious injuries, just having him be on the field and look like a Major League Baseball player is a good sign. We had no idea whether that would be the case coming into spring, and he has hit pretty well and has not hurt himself. And so there is, I think, some reason to hope that he will be useful this year. And I mean, Alex Rodriguez is just such a great player. 8-10 years ago when he was winning MVP awards for the Yankees, I mean, that's probably the best player I've ever seen on a regular basis in person as a New Yorker. I got to see him fairly often, and he was basically Mike Trout without the defense so much, but decent defense without the base running so much, but he was fantastic. So, I mean, there is some precedent for Hall of Fame, you know, inner circle Hall of Fame talented players to be productive at age 39 or 40. It has happened. I wouldn't count on it certainly, but he has made it a little bit more likely with what he's done this spring. He's only 5 months older than David Ortiz, right? And David Ortiz still seems to be one of the best hitters in baseball. So if his hips or however many problem areas of his body he has hold up, then he could conceivably be useful as a DH, maybe occasionally spot starter in the field or first baseman or wherever he plays. There's possible that he has enough left, and it'd be fun to see him give us some glimpses of the guy he used to be, even if he doesn't show that regularly.
Yeah, 2007 Alex Rodriguez is probably the best player I've ever watched in like a single season basis, like the whole time. And he was, if they could even get a small portion of that, that would really be valuable, because I feel like they haven't really gotten too much out of the DH spot since like maybe even Hideki Matsui in 2009 and a bit of Marcus Thames the next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even if he was just what he was his last couple of years before the injury or something close to that, just still an above-average hitter, not really a difference maker, but worth something. That would be enough to keep him from getting his contract eaten and released, probably.
Oh, man. It'll be pretty funny to see how the Yankees react to, like, him passing, like, home run milestones.
Yes,
contracts,
right.
Incentives.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Yankees kind of did a good job with signing Headley to minimize how good A-Rod needed to be. Because mm-hmm. if they brought him back expecting him to be the starting third baseman, then I see little way that wouldn't end in a ton of disappointment. But
right. Yeah, I like the Headley signing. Yeah, I do too. Heading into the offseason, the people who predict where free agents are going to go and how much they're going to sign for seem to think that Headley was going to get a much smaller deal. I don't know what he was projected to get by those people, but, you know, 3 years and 39 or something like that. And it seemed like a serious underestimate of how much he is worth. He's a good player. I know a lot of people drew the comparison between his projections for this year and Pablo Sandoval's, because Headley is projected to be better than Pablo Sandoval, and a lot of that is based on defense, and maybe that's not quite as reliable, and he's older than Sandoval, obviously, but he's a good player. He's a very good defensive player, and he hit a lot better after coming to the Yankees. He's stronger from the left side of the plate, so maybe Yankee Stadium will kind of pick up his bat a bit. Being out of Petco Park is nice. He's not super old. So I think they were smart to bring him back.
Yeah, it was really refreshing to see his defense at third base after what we were seeing from, like, I don't know, Yenher Solarte, Kelly Johnson, and even the previous few years with A-Rod at third, since he's not the defender he used to be. It was just kind of like a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, it was.
So in your Grantland preview, you picked the Yankees to finish last and have a sub-500 record. Since the AL East doesn't exactly have a ton of great talent right now, how realistic do you think fans can be about them making the playoffs?
It's quite possible. If I could have gotten away with not making predictions, I would have. Just in general, I don't think that I have some great ability to project baseball any better than a projection system does. So that, you know, not only that, but just the AL East is so tightly packed. I mentioned it in the intro to that preview that every team is projected to be between like 80 and 87 wins or something. And that's just, it's like within the margin of error with baseball projections, given how imprecise they are. So I wouldn't be surprised really by almost any ordering of these teams at the end of the season. I mean, I think the Yankees have the upside of a playoff team. It's not like you can't imagine a season in which they win the AL East or at least win a wild card. It's possible. I mean, their opening day roster is fairly strong in certain areas if you look at it. The question is just how much those players are going to play. What is their opening day roster going to look like compared to their roster in July or in September? I mean, if Tanaka and Sabathia and Pineda are making 30 starts, then sure, they could be very good. And maybe Nova comes back and replaces Warren or Capuano or whoever. And that has the makings of a really strong rotation, even if Sabathia isn't what he used to be. Even if he could just be a, you know, mid-rotation workhorse type, that would be great. If Tanaka could stay healthy, that'd be great. Pineda has looked really good. So if all those guys were making starts all season, then sure, the Yankees could be competitive with any team in this division. But those guys have to be among the biggest pitching injury risks in the division. So it's hard to say when you have a rotation built out of a few guys who can't really be counted on to stay healthy and then not a ton of rotation depth. So things could go terribly wrong, kind of like they did in 2014. And on offense, I mean, Beltran could bounce back and Teixeira could stay healthy and bounce back. And so could McCann, or all those guys could be hurt again. The Yankees have like 9 hitters projected to miss 25 games due to injury, according to Rob Arthur's injury projection, the Baseball Prospectus and now 538 author. Whereas if you look at a young team, they will have many fewer, like the Braves, and not that the Braves are great, but they're young and they have no one projected to miss that much time. And the projections are just based on age and previous injury history. So as long as the Yankees are old and have a long record of injuries, they have this capacity to, you know, just sort of self-destruct. But if everything goes right, then they have the talent to be good. So I can imagine any outcome being conceivable. I just, you know, I put them below the other teams just because they seem more vulnerable to all of those injuries that could really rob them of the talent that they seem to have today.
Yeah, one of my favorite predictions was Grant Brisby's predicting that the Yankees would finish in last place, but that Ellsbury would be the MVP, Tanaka wouldn't decide, Rhett Snyder wins Rookie of the Year, just because he doesn't want to double down on saying the Yankees are going down.
Yeah, Grant is very, very wary of, like, yeah. Yankees devil magic or something. Somehow he always seems to, I think it was when he wrote about Ichiro, the Ichiro trade to the Yankees, about how Ichiro seemed to be washed up at that point, and then he hit, you know, 300-something over the rest of that season, and that just played into Grant's paranoia about the Yankees. So, but we've seen in the last couple of years that things really can go wrong for the Yankees. It doesn't always work out for them.
Yeah, it has been pretty to watch, even though they've been over 500. I mean, Pythagorean records say that, like, they should have been under 500, and I'm pretty sure Brian Cashman has said before that he's been operating as though they had finished under 500, which is probably correct,
yes,
because they weren't fun
right.
teams to watch.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and a couple of people pointed out, you know, when I had that sub 500 prediction, and it was, you know, it's really just
it's predictions.
Right. The over under is set at like 500 and whatever I said under, but a couple of people pointed out that, you know, they won 84 games last year, so I'm saying that they're going to be worse than they were last year when so many things went wrong, but not necessarily. I think they could be better than they were last year and still win the same number of games or fewer games, just because they had the run differential of a whatever 77, 78 win team. And maybe that was partially having Betances having one of the most valuable relief seasons, you know, since Rivera was a setup man. But I don't know whether that'll happen again, given his velocity scare this spring training and just the fact that, you know, he was used a little bit more traditionally or conservatively as the year went on. And would probably pitch fewer innings and make less of an impact, even if he were just as effective inning per inning as he was last year.
Yeah, that was just unique to watch him just come out of almost nowhere to just become mm-hmm. one of the greatest relievers I've ever seen in just one season.
Yeah, that was great. And you don't usually see that. I mean, he was used, you know, before Girardi realized what he had and what Betances was, he was using him in the fifth inning or the sixth inning, and he was coming in for two innings at a time regularly. And when you do that, you can be extremely valuable. It's like Rivera when he was in 96 and, or, you know, 95, and he was a setup man and not coming in only in the ninth inning with three run leads a lot of the time. So you can really, affect the team's win probability a lot when you're used like that, and there aren't many relievers used like that, and I doubt Betances will be, because his usage was more traditional as the season went on.
Yeah. So you mentioned in the Yankees BP annual essay that they, quote, aren't totally inept at evaluating veteran talents, in reference to squeezing some wins from players like Kenley, Prado, McCarthy, Young, and even Capuano. Do you think mm-hmm. that this is a better use of major league scouting abilities, or does a decent major league scouting department almost bolster the idea that free agents over 30 will always be a big part of future plans?
Yeah, I think they should be probably a part of future plans if you're the Yankees and you have the financial resources of the Yankees. And I know it's sort of puzzling that they have completely gone away from that, it seems, in the, you know, the last several months, but I think it's, I mean, even if the conditions in Major League Baseball today are not as conducive to building a team with veterans as they once were, because during the PED era, for whatever reason, or if you just want to call it the high offense era, veterans were extremely productive, and not just Bonds and Clemens, but it was an atypical time for aging curves, and you could kind of count on over 30 players as a group were responsible for more of the wins over replacement player than under 30 players, which is very anomalous historically and wasn't the case before then and hasn't been the case after then. So you kind of have to have young guys now, but the Yankees should always probably have more old guys than the typical team, just because they have greater resources than the typical team. So even though there are fewer free agents available now, that there are these TV deals and, you know, the low payroll teams are now much higher payroll teams than they used to be, and they can afford to extend their young players who then don't become free agents until they're old and less interesting. There are still guys out there, and it's still encouraging, I think, that the Yankees have, you know, they were able to get someone like Brandon McCarthy, who seemed like a very strong bounce back candidate, and everyone on the internet pointed that out, and then the Yankees traded for him and got that bounce back, and Heavily worked out the same way, and Prado. So that was good. I think you could also point to McCann and Beltran as examples of guys who, you know, underperformed when the Yankees signed them. But it's probably a valuable skill for them to have. And they've kind of overhauled the minor league front office, you know, portion of the front office this year. Yeah. And, you know, new minor league directors and scouting directors and those kind of people, which can only be a good thing, probably, given how little success they've had drafting and developing players over the last couple decades, which is partially because they're the Yankees and they trade prospects and they don't get high draft picks. But even so, they haven't gotten a whole lot out of that. So some more scouting skills on that side would benefit them, too.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the Cardinals, and they've pretty much always picked toward the end of the draft anyway, because, you know, they've been so successful over the past 15 years or so, and yet they still have produced a pretty great farm system, so it's definitely still possible. And I think the hiring, it was Gary Denbo to replace Mark Newman was a pretty good move, just because it can never hurt to, like, break up the continuity, especially if it's not really producing results.
Yeah, I would think so. And he was a guy from within the organization, so yeah. I don't know how much of a difference in mindset it is, but we'll see. I mean, yeah, it gets to a point where even if you don't exactly know what's going on behind the scenes, you look at the results, and if they're bad enough for long enough, then you think that a change probably can't do anything but help. So that's kind of the point where they are right now.
Prior to joining Baseball Prospectus, you spent some time working for the Yankees. Without getting into too much detail, what do you think are the biggest weaknesses of public analytics, and how close are they in strength to private information?
I think it's just the quality of the data. You know, there are things that we just don't have, whether it's HitFX, which, you know, the Yankees and lots of analytically advanced teams have been using for years now, and can pinpoint players who, you know, maybe are hitting in bad luck and are doing things that should be leading to success but aren't for whatever reason. And we have proxies for that, right? Like, you can look at a guy's BABIP and maybe his BABIP was lower than it should have been, or you know, other companies like Baseball Info Solutions have just charted batted balls, like, you know, with stringers, guys who watch video and chart where the balls were and how hard they were hit, which is sort of a less precise analog of HitFX. And of course, that's not necessarily publicly available either. But yeah, I mean, there are just things that we're missing. And of course, we're missing scouting reports. And I think the public sector does a pretty good job of making up for some of those things. And there's a long history of baseball fans just gathering data themselves, going back to, you know, Project Score Sheet and Retro Sheet and all of those things that have given us the great play-by-play that no one had before, because Major League Baseball didn't even release box scores at one time, and it was impossible to do analysis without gathering your own data. So we have a lot, and there are things that we are missing, and we'll see whether StatCast, which is coming out this year and should be available to all teams, whether that will widen the gap or shrink the gap. It depends on how much of that is made public. And the league has been, you know, kind of vague on how much we will actually get and how much will be used on broadcast. And maybe some will be on MLB.com. But we don't know whether we'll get the same level of raw data that we have gotten with PitchFX, which has been immensely helpful. But based on my experience with the Yankees, you know, there is nothing that they aren't doing that other teams are doing, or, you know, that, like, there's no no need for a Yankees fan to worry that the Yankees are somehow behind the times or missing out on some potential innovation, which doesn't mean that they can always make the most of that because, you know, ownership might get in the way and that's always a concern. But as far as, you know, what they're looking at and what they're trying to do, I would put them pretty much on par with any other team in the league.
Yeah, I know when they traded for Chase Headley, one of the reasons that Cashman was excited by him was his hit velocity. And that's one of those stats that feel we are aware of in the public, but unfortunately we just can't really like measure that right now. And I'd be really fascinated to see the kind of data from other players.
Yeah, right. And there are equivalents of that. You know, like Inside Edge does this thing called hard hit average, which kind of, you know, tells you how often the guy is hitting the ball hard, even if he's not necessarily getting a hit. And so those are like, you know, less precise ways of looking at that. But yeah, I mean, there are things that we don't have access to that can give teams insights that we can't really make, which is unfortunate, but that totally makes sense that teams don't want to put all of that stuff out there.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Like field effects is another one of those things that seems to be big on the inside.
Yeah, StatCast is kind of replacing that, and it never totally, I think, worked the way they wanted it to or was implemented everywhere. But yeah, that and just, I don't know, things like wearable technology that, you know, can tell you things about players' health that we don't know. There's a lot between scouting and medical and analytical data sources that we don't have. There's a lot that we are missing, but I think on the whole, I don't know how many players there are that a team would value completely differently from WAR or whatever value metric we have. I mean, I think there are things that can tell you more quickly, you know, like StatCast would be able to tell you much more quickly if a guy is a good defender than UZR or defensive runs saved or something would. But I don't know how often they would disagree completely once you get a large enough sample size of those less precise measures.
Another point on the defense, what do you think about the polarizing beliefs teams seem to have on the need for defensive strength? The Yankees have obviously made it a point to bolster their defense, while the Red Sox are pretty content with Pablo Sandoval at third base and Hanley Ramirez in left field without him ever playing a game in left. And that seems to be like a disconnect of sorts that needs to be explored. It might just be the Red Sox saying, well, their bats are going to play well enough there that we don't care, but I wonder about the strength of their defense, though.
Yeah, I when I was looking at the defensive projections as I was doing the AL East preview for Grantland, it seemed like almost every team in the division measured pretty well. There wasn't one of those teams that is just punting defense and going with all sluggers. Even with the Red Sox, I mean, Hanley Ramirez as a shortstop was bad, but as a left fielder in a small left field, he could be fine. I mean, who knows? It might take him some time to adjust, but I don't think there's anything about his skill set that you would say couldn't, you know, keep up with other left fielders who tend to be the worst defenders in baseball as a group. So, or close to it. So, and Sandoval has not been bad, as his defensive performance seems to fluctuate with his weight to some degree, but, so who knows where his current weight is and where his current defense will be. But neither of those guys is, I don't think, a huge liability necessarily, and they've got good defenders elsewhere. So I think defense as a whole is probably still undervalued. You know, the more recent studies I've seen of what teams pay for in free agency, it still seems like things like power are, you know, command the most dollars and defense doesn't. And maybe that's because defense is harder to project than power is. But on the whole, it seems like, you know, if you're going to pay for wins, the wins that you get via defense come a little bit cheaper. So there's also the fact that defense is maybe a little less important today than it used to be just because there are fewer balls in play. I mean, there are so many strikeouts that if you compare the number of balls in play that a pitching staff allows over the course of a season now to what it was decades ago, I mean, it's hundreds, thousands fewer balls in play over the course of a season. So it matters a little bit less to have a good defender. But I think most of the teams in this division seem to be fielding pretty strong defenses, especially once you factor in their catchers. Like the Red Sox have Christian Vasquez, who seems to be a real catching prodigy, and the Rays have Rene Rivera, who is sort of the same way. And McCann is good too, of course. So once you factor in all that, and the Blue Jays getting Russell Martin, and there doesn't seem to be a really very weak defensive team in this division.
Yeah, I mean, the Red Sox were able to find some great success with Manny Ramirez faking it out in left field right. For so many years. So.
Uh huh. Yeah, it's not necessarily a prerequisite, but I think they'll be fine in that respect, and also a very good hitting team.
And I know Jeff Sullivan did an analysis at one point last year where he was talking about Derek Jeter and his shortstop defense, noting that, well, yes, Derek Jeter is not a very good defender for a shortstop. That doesn't mean that he's a bad defender overall, since shortstop just requires so much more, so that if he had been in another position, like Hanley Ramirez going out to left field, he could have been better.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a shortstop, you're a good defender in the grand scheme of things, even if you are one of the worst shortstops. That is, you know, the defensive ratings that you look up at Fangraphs or Baseball Reference or whatever are compared to your peers at the position. So if you're at a tough position, then you might look below average, but that's why the stat people factor in the positional adjustments too, to kind of put you on the same scale. So if you're a bad defensive shortstop, it still factors in the position that you play and the fact that it's much more difficult than other positions.
Speaking of the good catching defense, even if Brian McCann's bat remains around his 2014 levels or below that for the duration of his contract, do you think his defensive skills and pitch framing abilities can make his overall value worth the $85 million for 5 years?
It could maybe come close. I mean, I didn't think that was a terrible contract when it was signed. Of course, I expected him to hit better than he did. But yeah, I mean, he's a pretty good blocker. He's a very good framer. So that stuff definitely has value, unless there's some way in which framing gets minimized as a skill, like, robot umpires or umpires instructed to somehow ignore framing, which I don't think is possible, but I don't know, if there were some way that framing as a skill became less valuable, then he wouldn't be. But if he continues to do that, and there is an aging curve, there was, some recent research at BP that showed how framing ages, and it, more or less like other skills, that as you get deeper into your 30s, most guys get a little bit worse at framing, receiving also, it seems. And so he's 31 now, and maybe by the end of that contract, his glove is not quite the asset that it has been to this point. Even if you look at his rates of framing and receiving over the last couple of years, they don't seem to be quite what they were in the years before that. So maybe that's some sign of decline. I mean, and if he hits no better than he did last year, I don't think he could quite be worth what that contract pays him. But if his bat bounces back a little bit and his glove holds up, then yeah, sure. I don't think he needs to hit like he did in, 2010 or 2008 or his really good offensive years with the Braves to justify that money.
Yeah, I'll be fascinated to see how his production compares to Russell Martin, since Martin got a pretty similar deal from the Blue Jays. Mm-hmm. And I think Martin's might be a year older. They're roughly around the same age, but it'll be interesting to see how their production compares.
Yeah, and that was a lot to pay for Martin. I mean, they kind of paid for him to continue to be 2014 Pirates Russell Martin, and that was kind of an outlier offensive year for him. Right. Which is not the worst thing in the world for the Blue Jays, because they're trying to win right now, and if they have money to spend and they are kind of on the bubble playoff wise, then you pay a little more for Russell Martin, fine. It's not gonna kill them.
You made the playoffs for 22 years. You can try to
exactly. Yeah, if you're gonna splurge somewhere, it's not the worst place to splurge.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that they'll have fun trumpeting the fact that Martin's Canadian.
Yeah, they've got a few Canadian guys now, so I guess that's nice for some people there, for fans.
Yeah, though they did get rid of Laurie.
Yes, that's right, but they got Saunders.
I think they'll take Josh Donaldson in return.
I would think that's a fair trade-off for his Canadian and Americanness if you're going from Laurie to Donaldson, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so you were a Yankees fan growing up when the Yankees were dominating and winning championships in the late 90s and early 2000s. Mm-hmm. I know you'd mentioned Bernie Williams before, but did you have a favorite player? And what do you think about the Yankees announcing that they'll be retiring all the numbers this year?
Yeah, well, that is interesting. I mean, it's kind of this desperate attempt to ward off a huge attendance dip, I think. I wrote about this a bit in the Yankees essay in Baseball Prospectus Annual that, by all rights, the Yankees should have lost attendance last year just because historically, I mean, Yankees fans are used to winning. So when the team doesn't win, they have larger attendance drops than the typical team. And that seemed to be the case in 2013. They had a pretty significant drop, even though that was the Mariano Rivera retirement tour year. And you'd think going into last year when they were really never the favorites in the division and kind of, you know, fell out of contention, or not contention, but they, you know, were always sort of long shots to make the playoffs beyond midseason or so. And you'd think that the fans would have deserted except for the Jeter factor and the fact that Jeter was in the lineup almost every day and doing his farewell tour. The Yankees actually gained attendance, which is kind of incredible. So, you know, not having a retiring player this year that people will come to the park to see, and for the third straight year having a team that seems unlikely to make the playoffs, though certainly not out of the question, you would think that they would have a pretty hard hit coming their way, that, you know, the attendance decline that should have happened last year might happen, like, with a vengeance this year. So it seems like their strategy is just to have as many, you know, nostalgia-inducing ceremonies as possible. And I was joking in my preview about, like, Luis Polonia night, because it seems that they're almost getting to that point. But no, I mean, I don't know. Like, if you're it's not a bad thing, right? Like, some people might feel that they are, I don't know, tarnishing the Yankees' legacy by putting, I don't know, a lower tier of player in Monument Park or whatever. But, I mean, there are, you know, players in there who are among the best of all time already. So if you're going to have Billy Martin in there or Roger Maris in there or whatever, I mean, you know, putting Jorge Posada in or Paul O'Neill in or whoever is going in, Andy Pettit, it's not really a step down. And those are really popular players. So I don't see a big problem with it if fans like it and those guys get to have their day and Yankees fans get to feel good and have some fond memories of the times that those players play, then great. And, you know, it's fine with me. I don't know that it will have anything like the impact that a Jeter retirement tour has financially. But if you get a sellout in some day that otherwise, you know, 30,000 fans will be there because you're bringing back Andy Pettit or Jorge Posada, then might as well do it. And then you get to use those guys as ambassadors for your brand for the next few decades and have them go to events and old timers days. And that's, you know, an advantage that the Yankees have that most other teams don't have, is this long history and these great players that they can bring back, and maybe they can teach younger players something, or they can just, you know, contribute to the attachment that fans feel to the team. So if you're the Yankees and you have that in your quiver, you might as well use it. And as for favorite players, I mean, Bernie Williams was my favorite player as a kid. Not only because he was an excellent player and maybe an underrated player, but I was attracted to his demeanor and personality, you know, as like a not super intense or jockey person myself. He kind of seemed like this quiet, gentle guy who got along with everyone and, you know, was a competitor, but wasn't as openly intense as, say, Paul O'Neill was. And I like Paul O'Neill too, but Bernie Williams was definitely a favorite at that time.
Yeah, he just seemed like one of those guys. You just wanted to go hit some dingers, then play some guitar a little bit.
Right. Yeah, and there aren't that many people like that in the major leagues. I mean, to get to the major leagues, you have to be pretty intense and driven. And he was, you know, he was those things, I guess, but he was kind of a gentle soul, or he seemed to be. And there aren't a whole lot of people like that in clubhouses. So that was nice. I liked Bernie a lot.
Yeah, and I'm sure it also appealed to you that he came up before all that, you know, the core four thing. It's really the core four and Bernie, because Bernie's was the first of them and really deserves to be in that discussion with all those other guys.
Definitely does, yeah, and contributed just as much as most of them did. So, yeah, I would definitely list him alongside those guys as, you know, among players who contributed to those teams.
Mm-hmm. And you had mentioned that attendance possibly dipping, and I think that'll be kind of fascinating to see how many fans come out to the park this year, because you could see an effect where, you know, after the Yankees stopped winning championships in like the 70s and they were up and down in the 80s, there are a lot of clips of Don Mattingly hitting these long homers into the upper deck where no one is there.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know if it'll go quite to that extreme again, but it'll be definitely interesting to see how many people come out.
Yeah, I
mean, non-retire number games.
Right. And yeah, and they're not a bad team. I mean, if this is as bad as it gets for the Yankees, you know, the modern Yankees, then that's pretty good. I mean, most teams would gladly, you know, have their nadirs be 82 wins or whatever it is for the Yankees. If this is as bad as it gets, that's not really a hardship. But you're right. I mean, you know, coming off of teams that made the playoffs every year and won the World Series many years, it just, you know, doesn't offer the same adrenaline that those teams did. So we will see. That will be one of the more interesting storylines of the season, though maybe not a positive or reassuring one.
Mm-hmm. I'm still holding out hope for Clay Bellinger Day. So
Clay Bellinger was the first autograph I ever got. I was never like a big autograph collector. I went down to spring training a few times as a kid, and you know, my mom was always like, go, like, line up against the fence with all the other kids and, like, you know, try to get this guy to sign your baseball. And I just never really wanted to do that. I felt like I was imposing on these players, kind of. But, yeah, Clay Bellinger tossed me an autographed ball once. So I still have it somewhere. It's probably worth less than a clean baseball with no signature on it. But that is my Clay Bellinger memory.
I wonder if there's like a Clay Bellinger signed memorabilia collection. Maybe someone's really interested in that.
Yeah, I mean, maybe
Mrs.
scarcity.
Bellinger, possibly.
Right. I don't know what Clay Bellinger is up to these days. Let's see. I'm on eBay looking for Clay Bellinger autographed.
I just did that.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. There's a Clay Bellinger autographed 99 2000 World Series champ baseball selling by Steiner Sports for $80. So. No takers. Yeah, no takers so far, but you can go buy that.
Oh man, that's amazing.
It's $80, but it's in a glass case with a pedestal, so maybe that is mostly the price of the pedestal. I don't know.
Oh, that sounds like a classic Steiner Sports investment.
Yeah,
remember,
well,
they're trying to like sell the dirt. I think they sell the
dirt.
Sell the
yeah,
dirt from the old stadium.
They will sell anything, and I guess someone will buy it.
So I guess our last question is, the Yankees have some highly touted minor leaguers in Aaron Judge, Luis Severino, and Greg Bird, and they've all experienced success so far, but they haven't played too much above A-ball. How high does a prospect need to reach level-wise before really making an impression on you?
I think it's fair to get excited about anyone at any level, especially if you're a Yankees fan and haven't had a ton of prospects to get excited about recently. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So if you want to get excited about someone, go ahead and get excited about someone. I'm not a prospect person. That is not my specialty. When I write about prospects, I generally will reference someone who is a specialist in prospects, or will talk to someone who is. But all those guys are pretty interesting. I like Greg Bird, just because he has hit really well. And if you look at, I don't know, a couple of years ago, I just sorted a minor league leaderboard by true average, which is Baseball Prospectus's park and league adjusted stat. And he was like at the top of that league. And that's always interesting. I guess usually the divide between the, you know, scouting type and the sabermetric person who just kind of looks at prospects as a hobby is that, you know, we get excited about guys who perform well, whereas the scouting person will look at the tools and the potential, and sometimes the guys who perform well are not going to continue to perform well. But Bird has hit really well when he's played at every level so far, and that's encouraging. But, you know, the problem with him is that he's had back issues, and that's always sort of scary for a hitter, particularly a hitter who is a first baseman. And, you know, his whole value is tied up in his bat, more or less. So he really has to hit very well to make it to the majors. And, you know, I guess he could be like a Connor Jackson type who was around for a while and could hit 20 homers and get on base or something, and, you know, Lyle Overbay or something, have some good offensive years, never be a star. And the other guys, I mean, Severino, you know, there's scouts seem split on whether he could be a bullpen guy or a starter, but he seems to have really good command and control, and that's good for a guy who is so young and throws so hard. And so there are things to like about all of those guys. And, you know, I don't know that there's really a cutoff point where, okay, now you can get excited about this guy. It's just sort of a spectrum or a scale. And, you know, the closer they get, the more excited you can be, and the safer they are, and the better the probability that their production will actually translate to the majors and something won't go horribly wrong before they get there. So it's encouraging. I guess it's the best crop of high ceiling guys that the Yankees have had for a few years now. So it's good. So I guess, you know, we'll see whether they stick to this new financial restraint or whether they go back to being the old Yankees and trade prospects for veterans and sign guys who require giving up draft picks and all those things that make it hard to build a farm system. I mean, if the Yankees can eventually get to the point where, you know, they're the Cubs or the Red Sox and they've got a good major league team and a very deep farm system, or the Dodgers, who are basically what the Yankees were, you know, a decade ago at this point, then they should be in a very good position. For now, they are kind of in this transition between a model of team building that wasn't really working anymore and a model that hopefully will work for the long term. But they're in this awkward transition stage that they're just going to have to get through. And, you know, hopefully for Yankees fans, it won't get much worse than it has been to this point.
Yeah, you mentioned Greg Bird had that one season. It was probably in Charleston, 2013. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
he had one game where he hit three home runs and Tanya was actually there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So that's enough to probably like imprint a prospect on you. If you see him have a day like that, it's like, oh, well, I like this guy. So
I have a pretty big obsession with Greg Bird.
Yeah. You always have to be careful. Like, you know, if you see a guy on a particularly good or bad day, then you can get too attached to him or write him off too quickly. But yeah, there's a lot to like about him.
Okay, I don't have any other questions. Do you have any more, Tanya?
I don't have any more.
All right, well, thanks for having us on, Ben. Thanks for coming on to our podcast, Ben.
I am happy to.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah. I've been writing a lot about the Yankees lately, so it was not a problem to translate some of those sentences into words.
And Ben's very easy to find on Twitter. It's just at Ben Lindbergh. And
mm-hmm.
I think at one time I found you also had like a Ben _ Lindbergh, and then you said
I did. I used to be an _, and then I realized that the _ wasn't doing anything for me, so I got rid of it.
Mm-hmm. I think you said something like I've assumed his powers or something like that.
Yes, just in case people go to the _ page, they can find me at the non_ page.
Yes. And you can, of course, find Ben on Grantland, and you can listen to him on the Effectively Wild podcast with Sam Miller. So thanks again for coming on, Ben.
Yeah, no problem. It's fun. Mm-hmm.
All right. So that'll do it for us on the Pinstripe Alley podcast. You can follow me on Twitter at MearnsPSA. You can follow Tanya on Twitter at Tanya Bondurant. You can follow the Pinstripe Alley Gifts account at PSA_gifts, and of course follow Pinstripe Alley in general at Pinstripe Alley.
Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/PinstripeAlley. And rate and review us on iTunes. Always enjoy hearing feedback. And whenever we put up a tweet bag for questions to ask us on the regular podcast, please feel free to send them in to @PinstripeAlley or post them on the site. That'll do it for us. So for Ben, Tanya, have a great night.